Okay, so welcome everybody to the beginning of lesson four. But before we start lesson four, let us quickly remember lesson three was the qualifications we need to have in order to be eager for shelter. And what were they, quickly, just to see how much you're remembering, without looking in the paper?
And then respect,
and helplessness. Yeah, humility is the basic, qualification, and that humility manifests as inquisitiveness, as respect, as helplessness. Exactly. One quick little thing I want to add in regards to the helplessness, which I forgot to mention. We can understand there is two kinds of helplessness. There's material helplessness and there's spiritual helplessness. So material means not connected to Krishna, right? Whereas spiritual means connected with Krishna. So material helplessness is when we keep ourselves in the center and we indulge in some self-pity. Oh, poor me, I'll never make it. I'm so useless. Oh my God. And. So if we just go around in circles around ourselves, simply feeling pity for ourselves, this is actually some kind of subtle sense enjoyment. Me and mine, I'm so useless and hopeless. And, feeling pity for oneself. So that kind of helplessness is useless. This is just leads to tamaguna and depression and becoming suicidal and maybe even giving up the process of Krishna consciousness or something. So that's definitely not the helplessness we were talking about, right? Just to make it clear that there's no misunderstandings. But spiritual helplessness, we move Krishna to the center. Yes, I realize I'm helpless. I'm, fallen. I cannot make it by myself, so let me better take tightly shelter of Krishna and his devotees and Guru and Prabhupada and then we move them in the center. Right? So in that kind of helplessness, that is uplifting because it leads to taking more tightly shelter. Right? Clear the difference? Yes? Not that we mix up the two and think, I'm so helpless and drown in self-pity there or something. So that's not what we're talking about. Okay, so now, are there any more comments, questions about that before we start the next session? All right, so, okay.
Regarding respect, so here there are some phrases about what should Vaishnava have, what need to have in order to respect this, like Vaishnava should respect everything you, what take respect to be from all these two techniques. Sometimes we really discuss all these things without knowing what that really means, respect according to Vaishnava culture, how we define it.
So the question is how we define respect according to Vaishnav culture. Often we discuss these things and then...
In order to develop all these things which are mentioned here.
Yes. Well, all these things which are mentioned here, they're meant to give us some insight what respect means. Basically respect comes... from humility. It's a manifestation of humility. If we actually understand our tiny and insignificant position, then we naturally have respect for one and all. We consider ourselves, unqualified, and then we will respect. And not only because of that, but we as we become more purified and as our relationship with Krishna is more tangibly established through chanting, which we will discuss next weekend, you know, as our relationship becomes more tangibly established, we will see every living entity as part and parcel of Krishna. And that is the ultimate, you know, platform of respect and also personalism. That's the ultimate personalism, that we are personal with everyone because we can see everyone as part and parcel of Krishna. That's true personalism. If we are personal, you know, to some and not to some, and some we like, they're our friends, and some we don't like, they're not our friends. So then we are still on the platform of duality. But once we transcend that platform of duality, we can actually be personal with each and every one, even with our so-called enemies. Because we understand actually, you know, that person is simply covered over and in a diseased condition, but actually there is an all beautiful soul there, and you know, so it's just a temporary situation. So even with people who are very nasty towards us or something, we can actually still act as their friend and well-wisher. Maybe we have to take a bit of a distance because the person cannot, you know, associate with us, and we don't want to put that person in a position where they commit some offense or something. But so that's true personalism based on my relationship with Krishna. And in the same way, true respect in the ultimate sense will be firmly established as, you know, as our relationship with Krishna is more manifest, and then we can see each and every spirit soul, even each tree we can see as part and parcel of Krishna. We can see actually there is a personality inside this tree. There is, right? Or in a cat or a dog or something. We can understand actually in that body there is a personality trapped in that body. And therefore we can be respectful because we understand it's an eternal spirit soul, part and parcel of Krishna. And how unfortunate to have such kind of a body, you know? Right? Does that make it a bit more clear? But see, as we don't have that vision yet, therefore we need the Vaishnava etiquette. That's, again, that's why Vaishnava etiquette in culture is so important, because it gives, it's like the crutches on which we move forward, you know, as we have not gotten that pure transcendental vision yet. Krishna gives us the framework how to act as if we had it already, but we are not quite there yet. So then we just follow the Vaishnava etiquette and culture, and that's a whole supportive system in order to help us develop that vision which we should be getting, which we are striving for. Right? But if we don't follow Vaishnava etiquette and culture, then even though we might be chanting and hearing the Bhagavatam and everything, we always fall back into mundane ego, envy, envious, behavior, patterns of behavior. And that's really like the elephant taking bath and throwing dirt on his back again, you know. Then we are trapped in that mundane ego behavior, and we commit offenses and we can't get out of there. Does it make sense? Yeah, that's why we need this etiquette and culture. It's immensely supportive. Yes.
There is one more specific question she has. When someone acts incorrectly or offensively,
yes,
then how to have respect for that?
So when one behaves I was asked to repeat the question. When one acts incorrectly and offensively, how to maintain the respect? Well, that's what we were discussing the other day. What actually makes it impossible for us, or let's say difficult for us, to be respectful to a person who behaves incorrectly, is actually a sort of envy. Because then we are judging, oh, that person commits offense. Well, actually, I'm better than that person because I don't commit that offense and I can recognize that offense. And therefore, how can I respect this person? You know, then we are evaluating who is better here. Right? Yes, it is actually, you know, it comes from envy that we cannot respect, even though there are some shortcomings and difficulties. But if we are free from envy, you know, then we can be respectful towards that person because we understand there is a condition, it's all there. You know? And it's just a disease condition at the moment. Like I was giving that example with the hospital. Just the fact that somebody vomits and passes stool there on the corridor in the hospital and is sick, you know, we can say behaves obnoxiously. You know, it doesn't give us a reason to disrespect the person. No. No, we understand. The person is sick and how unfortunate. How can I help that person? So there will not be disrespect. Yeah? As I'm saying, even tree we should have respect. Even a computer bag we should move aside with a foot, as I was saying last time, you know? Because we have that vision, it's all part of Krishna's energy, you know? So now how to deal with that when a person commits an offense? Again, we were discussing, but I emphasize it one more time because it's so important. It depends on our relationship with that person. And it has to be our service to correct that person. And we can correct a person only if that person has faith in us. Just the fact that the person is doing something wrong does not give us the right to go up to the person and correct. No, no. It has to be our service. We have to have the appropriate relationship with that person, that there is a trusting relationship there. And we have to be acting as a senior who is meant to correct that person. So if these things are not there, you know, if it's not our service, if that person doesn't have a trusting relationship with us, and we are not in a superior position where we are meant to correct that person, then we have to go to somebody who is in that position. The person's mentor, the person's authority, the person's guru. Then our duty is to simply report to a person who is in that position to correct. We tell that person, oh, by the way, I've noticed something, you know, and this and this and this. Then we have done our duty. And then we leave it up to that person to decide what to do with the situation. Maybe we are just imagining it all. Could be. That it's our own envy coming in there and we are detecting all kinds of things which we are actually projecting. We have them ourselves and we think the other person has that or whatever, you know. So maybe we are imagining it all. Could be. So that's why we simply report to a person whose service it is to correct that person, who's got that trusting relationship with that person, and who is a senior authority who is meant to correct that person. And then we simply leave it up to them. We simply report and leave it up to them. Then we've done our duty. And it is our duty if we see something, even in seniors, you know, if we see something in a senior person and we feel, oh my God, gee, that somehow somebody has to do something about this. But we understand it's definitely not my position, especially when a person is senior. My God, you know, it's not our position to go up to this person and confront this person or something. Oh my God, ah, terrible, 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 you know. So, when we see something in a senior person, yes, it is our duty to report it. to somebody whose position it is to correct that person. And then leave it up to them. Let them deal with it. Because also, see, we have to understand many things, unwanted things, anattas, this, that, they cannot be corrected just by somebody telling always, oh, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, you know. I mean, my God, our gurus would have a lot of work there, you know, to constantly correct us or something. Now, many things will be corrected in due course of time through purification. Many things, no use to address them all the time or something. So that requires a little bit of expertise to see, you know, what needs to be corrected and what we just, you know, let it be. It will sooner or later, it will be adjusted through purification and. It's a whole art to actually help somebody to rectify themselves, you know. It's a whole art. And one has to actually, according to Vaishnava etiquette, one actually has to be non-envious to really give effective correction. Yes. I saw the other day on Dandavat, sometimes I'm looking there a little bit, even though I don't really have so much time. Kadambakarna Swami was writing a whole little thing there. Or maybe it was just an excerpt of a conversation or lecture where he was making this point. You know, we cannot be a society of correcting each other all the time, you know. No. Yeah, and as we were discussing, it is easily comes about through envy, you know, that we always want to establish that we know everything better and we are superior and so on. But yeah, that's why we have to know the etiquette of correcting. That just the fact somebody is doing something wrong doesn't give us the right to correct, you know? Yes. And also, like, we don't correct a person in front of others. Oh, this is again, oh, such bad etiquette, you know? Especially not in front of juniors. Ah, this is completely ridiculous. You know? Let's say a temple department head or something is doing something wrong, and then his authority, the temple president or something, corrects him, gets on his case in front of his subordinates. You know, this is really low-class behavior, actually, you know. Let's imagine how that person feels, you know, getting corrected and chastised in front of those who he is meant to be an authority for. You know, this will create a very bad feeling, and how can he accept this nicely and so on, you know. Oh, my God, you know. But even in front of others, you know, no, it just becomes a whole painful thing, and naturally if there's so many other people there, and then, you know, that affects the ego more, and then there's a whole, you know, whole thing there, oh, who is right and who is wrong here, and, oh, no, the correction is always done in privacy, you know, and there has to be the right relationship there, and it has to be in a nice, affectionate mood of wanting to serve, you know, and uplift that person and help that person, and not in some way or something. You know, it's just contaminating everybody present if it's not done in a non-envious way. Yeah. So that's a whole topic, you know. And I mean, since it is relating to being a counselor, which is a topic for today, you know, we have to have the qualifications of being a counselor. I mean, that's a pretty important thing. We have to know, you know, how to correct in a well-wishing mood, you know, and when it is our service to correct somebody, you know, it's an important thing to know as a counselor. Otherwise, we can just create havoc, you know, if we do it in wrong ways and yeah. Okay, well, I guess that was a pretty good introduction to the lesson number 4. Do we have the material somewhere? Yes. Maybe quickly give a part to the men that they can also serve it out. I have to already announce, while we're giving out the papers, especially tomorrow evening will be a pretty important session, and I'm hoping that really maximum people will take part, because this will be the conclusive session, especially in practical terms, how to actually apply this all now, and how to actually really start or a mentoring system, or if there is already some start, how to fine tune it to make it actually effective. So even though tomorrow morning when we start lesson number 5, it seems like there's not so much there on the paper or something, but it doesn't mean that it is not important, that there's nothing to talk about. No, you know, that the conclusive tomorrow evening session, I have not made any materials for that, because it's a very individual thing according to where Yatra is at and this and that. You know, and it will be another last chance to really come up with all kinds of questions which might have not been addressed or something. Because ultimately, as you may realize, this seminar is mainly effective if it is followed up with some implementation. Right? Otherwise, if we just leave it everything as it is and we think, oh yeah, well, was pretty interesting, you know, no, then it's not so effective. You know, we actually want to take it further. We want to realize, yes, these sheltering relationships are so important. So what is the next step for us here in Ljubljana to actually implement this and give some facilitation? You know, that we can actually facilitate this important thing and help devotees to develop sheltering relationships. So that will be the topic for tomorrow evening. So I'm really hoping that tomorrow evening we have really everybody here who has some interest in this, and or at least watch it over internet. But naturally, if one is here personally, one can take more part in the discussions and ask questions and so on, you know, like that. Okay, so let me turn the page also here to lesson number 4. Yeah, so today we will start, and in the evening we will conclude this topic of qualities required to be able to give shelter. And one more time, we've mentioned it a few times, but why is this such an important topic? Two reasons. Why do we clearly have to understand what are the required qualifications in order to be able to give shelter? Why is this so important? Come on. That devotees stay in the process. No, more precisely, there's two reasons why this is so super important for everyone to know what are the qualifications for a person in order to give shelter. So we know to whom we go. Exactly. So we can see who is qualified. Because if we take shelter in an unqualified person, we might be very disappointed and discouraged and pained, and we think, ah, this is just not working anyway. You know, so we have to know the qualifications. And what's the second reason? There's one more reason.
The one that wants to give shelter, what he means.
Yeah, so that we, you know, the person who wants to give shelter, that he knows what qualifications he has to develop, and sooner or later we all should grow into this position of giving shelter. As we said, if we don't develop that mood, then our life is superficial, and our relationships are superficial. So we don't forever want to lead a superficial life. We want to grow, you know, grow up. That's what it means to actually make advancement, to become a mature devotee, that we have a burning desire to reach out to those, you know, in an inferior position, and we want to affectionately uplift them. So we all have to, you know, aspire for that. sooner or later. And we should clearly know what to aspire for, right? Actually, very often when I give these seminars, especially some grihasthas who have been around for quite a while, they really feel very encouraged by getting very concrete aims and targets, what to strive for. Because sometimes, you know, well, let's say grihasthas have been around for 20, 25, 30 years, and they often feel in that dilemma, well, how can I contribute to the yatra, you know? All right, I've done the artis, and I've cooked the Sunday feast, and you know, I've done all this for many years, so well, what else is there for me to do? Yeah? And they feel a little, oh, actually nobody really needs me there at the temple, and all right, they come to the Sunday program, and you know, but they don't know how they can actually become a more valuable member of the community. So here we find the answer, giving shelter. That's what they are meant to do. That's how they're meant to contribute, by reaching out to the young folks and helping them and guiding them and sharing their life experience. I think I mentioned it, that this is also the great valuable contribution of the Vanaprastha Ashram. You know, the Vanaprasthas are meant to play that role. But because this whole giving and accepting shelter is not deeply understood, how important this is, because it's not part of materialistic culture, as we have said. Nobody wants to give shelter, nobody wants to take shelter in material life. You know, that's because we haven't deeply understood this. That's why the Vanaprastha Ashram cannot really manifest, because their highly valuable contribution is not understood. You know, usually we value devotees according to two things: how much service they can do and how much money they can give. But Vanaprastha is not in that category. The body gets older, you can't run around like mad and do all these services. You're getting older. And Vanaprastha, well, it also means, you know, actually the grihasthas are meant to provide for the Vanaprasthas, actually. So the Vanaprasthas are not in that position to give big amounts of money. They're not working anymore, they're retired, you know. So that's why very easily we think, these old people, you know, no value. They can't do any services that much, and they don't have any money to give. So, you know, and then they're pushed aside, and we don't realize how much wealth of life experience they have to give, that they have, they can give. And we're missing out on all that. And, yeah, because this whole giving and accepting shelter is not happening. And as a result, we run to our sannyasi gurus with all our family issues. I had gurus telling me 75% of their time and energy goes by working their disciples' family issues. But this should not be. They should not have to deal with this. This is all meant to be taken care of by vanaprasthas and mentors. Yeah? Yeah, so that's the whole thing. Okay, so that's why we have to know what to strive for. You know, how to actually become qualified and mature in our spiritual practice so we can be an effective shelter giver. Yes. Very satisfying to the heart to try and do that service, because devotees are so dear to Krishna, you know, and if we serve the devotees in that way of trying to nourish them and guide them and help them, that is just so pleasing to Krishna that we feel so much deep satisfaction as reciprocation from Krishna being pleased. Yeah, yes. For myself, in my eyes, it's actually the best way to serve devotees, really, you know, by reaching out to them and yes. So let's have a look at the qualifications. So the one main and foremost one is that we can only give shelter if we have shelter ourselves. Yeah? We cannot give something that we don't have. And very easily we tend to overlook this, you know. We might be experienced and senior and we think, yes, sure, I can give shelter and. But we don't realize, hey, have I got shelter? Am I shelter? Do I have such a trusting, sheltering relationship in my life? We might be thinking, oh, I don't need this. I've been around for 35 years. I know, you know, and then we don't even realize that we have to start with ourselves. We have to be sheltered first. And proportionally to how much we are sheltered, we can give shelter to others. So that's why main and foremost step number one is we all have to be sheltered first, you know? We have to have such trusting, confidential relationship where we want to be corrected. Yes, yes. Not just some formality thing, yeah, I have my guru or something. No. You know, we have to have such a trusting relationship where that person, you know, is such a dearmost friend and well-wisher that we can share our innermost struggles and fears and things which are extremely embarrassing and we would not want to have others know. You know, we might have some problem, some secret problem there and following the principles or whatever it may be. You know, but no, that one person, I can tell that person. You know, such a relationship, a shelter giver has to have also. Otherwise he is handicapped, you know. He cannot really give proper shelter. You know? And I mean, we can ask, so what's the danger if a person doesn't have those sheltering relationships, but he wants to be a shelter giver? So what can very easily happen? Do you imagine, you know, you have a mentor, but he is not sheltered. Or you are acting as a mentor, but you are not sheltered. So, what's the danger? Come on.
Pride.
Yeah, pride, and?
That person taking shelter in his or her own mind. It's very dangerous.
Yeah, so a person can take shelter in his or her own mind. So, and what are the results practically? What can happen? Get overburdened. Or simply go off the track. Right? And then there's nobody there who can tap him on the shoulder or something. And also you as a mentee, you know, everybody understands that mentor, mentee. The mentee is the one who accepts a person as a mentor. So if the mentee sees something which is maybe a little strange or something, well, he's got nobody to report to if that person doesn't have a mentor also. Right? So, and one easily can go off the track. One can fall down, overburdened, not realizing, you know, that one takes on too much or something. Not realizing one's own practice is imbalanced and, you know, so, and one can really crash, you know. As I was mentioning, that's what all those Diksha gurus had in common who could not maintain their position, that they did not have this confidential trusting relationship with equals or those who are a little stronger, you know. There's always somebody who's a little stronger than us. Just the fact that they're God brothers or something doesn't mean that they're all on the same level of spiritual strength or something. No, definitely not. Yes. And we set the example of Bharat Maharaj, you know, typical devotee care story, you know, Bharat Maharaj trying to reach out to the deer and taking birth as a deer because he was not sheltered. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So that's the first main and foremost basic condition base that we can say that the person has to be sheltered him or herself. So then, now we have a whole list here of things, and some are pretty self-explanatory and don't need so much discussion, but some, you know, we can elaborate a bit and unpack a little bit. So the first one, should have a nice understanding of the philosophy and practice of Krishna consciousness. It's pretty broad in general, but, well, that's what it is. One should have a nice understanding of the philosophy and how to practice. So it doesn't mean that one has to be a big scholar, a big pundit. One doesn't even have to be a class giver necessarily, you know, a preacher, a good speaker. No, it's not required. But one has to have a nice understanding of the philosophy. One has to understand the basic elements of Krishna conscious philosophy and the practice, how to apply it, how to live it. There has to be some good understanding there. Right? And next one is even more vague. Should have been act. By the way, let me clarify this. This list is not my creation. It's not that I speculated these things or something. But no, they come in Parampara actually. You can find this list in Ranjaswami's book, Taking Care of Krishna's Devotees. Anybody knows this book? Few people, yes. There is this list, and as far as I know, he's got it from Ranaswami. I think there's also some booklet that Ranaswami put together where also this list is mentioned. And I think maybe I added a couple at the end or something. But yeah, just to share that, it's not just, oh, what the Vaki Madhaji thinks is necessary or something, but no, it comes in the Parampara there, you know. So, and they formulated it exactly like this, the next one. Should have been active within ISKCON for a reasonable length of time, which can be anything, right? Reasonable length of time, what's that, you know? So, as far as I understand, it is expressed that way because one cannot put an exact amount of years, you know. You cannot say one should have been active within ISKCON for 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, 15 years. No, one cannot put some exact figure there because it's a very individual thing. It depends how we apply ourselves to the practice, how we put ourselves in the fire of service. It depends how deeply we are chanting, you know. There's so many factors. We can be blabbering something, taking empty medicine capsules, as Sachinanda Swami calls it. And we can practice like that for 30 years, and still we might not be really necessarily qualified to be a shelter giver. So one cannot put some precise number of years there. So that's why it is expressed in a very stretchy way, you know, reasonable length of time. Really, that can be anything. So, in other words, it is a very individual matter of discrimination that somebody has to see, you know. Is this person qualified? Is the reasonable length of time, is that enough time for this person or not enough time? Very individual thing. Has to be looked at from case to case. Whether that person has received a nice understanding of the philosophy and practice of Krishna consciousness through the time period he's been practicing, and also looking, though there's so many more things to come, you know, and that makes it very clear that one cannot put a precise amount of time there or something. Right? Now, next one. Should be able to give balanced advice according to time, place, and circumstances. So that's a pretty important thing. you know, to be able to give balanced advice. Because practice of Krishna consciousness, well, that's what it's all about, to get the right balance. Right? To see if it's all balanced, not too much of this and not enough of that, and, but it all has to be nicely balanced. Right? And I mean, what, in order to give balanced advice, what does the caregiver has to be also? Exactly. He himself has to be balanced, right? Otherwise, how can he give balanced advice if he leads an unbalanced life on all levels? You know? That starts almost, you know, at the very practical thing of leading a balanced life and practical aspects, regulated, balanced, you know, and then also having a balanced understanding and vision of things. So the person has to be well balanced. And only then he can give balanced advice. Again, you know, we cannot give something which we don't have ourselves. Yes. And also, we can say it is certainly helpful if the caregiver has experience in all different services. This is actually what Prabhupada wanted. Then when a devotee comes, and that's how it was 30 years ago, you know, now often it's not like that anymore. But, you know, at least in my days when I joined, we were going through the whole mill there, you know. We were going through all the departments. First, you know, you might be in the pujari room, as in Madhiji at least, making garlands. Then you go out in Sankirtan. So then as soon as you get second initiation, boom, you're on the altar there, getting some basic understanding of puja. You're in the kitchen, cooking offerings for the Lord. Or before you get second initiation, well, you help in the general kitchen there for the devotee kitchen, cutting up for the Sunday program, getting some idea how things function in the kitchen, cleanliness, and. So, you know, you go through the whole spectrum there of training so that you have some experience in all fields of services. And then we can even more easily give balanced advice because we know what it means to be on the altar. We know what it means to be on the kitchen. We know what it means to be out on book distribution. You know, and then we can encourage and give balanced advice because we have some experience in it. Yeah? But very often these days it's like that people come and they immediately specialize. And then they've been around for 20 years, but they don't even know how to do an arti. You know, this happens. Or they don't know how to make a chapati or a khichdi or something. You know? But it's very, very narrow training. I mean, Prabhupada wanted devotees to be expert in all fields of service. And then later, we can specialize. We can see what tendencies we have and where we really can, you know, develop ourselves more or something. But the basic things of some puja and some cooking and some book distribution, I mean, we are Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement. So everybody should have some experience of what it is like to give a person a book, you know? Yes, even if we might struggle and we can't really do it so well and we don't get some big results, but still we should imbibe that Sankirtan spirit, you know, because it's a certain consciousness, it's a spirit which we all have to carry, even when we're married and we are mothers, you know. But if we have been on Sankirtan, then when we go to the supermarket, we take a little, at least an invitation card to the Sunday program with us, and we look, oh, where's that soul who I can give a card, and so on. And then the going shopping becomes a Sankirtan adventure, you know. So it's a certain consciousness we have to have. But if we've never been out and distributed a book or something and we don't have experience in that spirit, then, yeah, then something is lacking, and then we will not be able to give such balanced advice. Yes. Any comment or question about that, those points? Yes, Prabhu.
We have now at that time all the work is read through temple trainings. Not so many congregations now. So now it's opposite. Just few devotees within the temple, and other devotees are living outside. So how to balance these things, that they can understand, they can go also through some experiences with these kind of services.
Yes. So the beginning,
that
which
we can understand each other also.
Yes.
Because many times congregation members seek shelter of temple devotees, and also sometimes temple devotees seek shelter of congregational devotees.
Okay.
Is
so what goes through the microphone, the internet audience hears?
Yes. No need to.
Okay, no need to repeat. Good. Yes. So, I mean, first of all, let's understand this, that the ideal situation in Krishna's system is that people go through all the ashrams, that even the congregational members actually ideally should have also gotten some training as brahmacharis, you know, and brahmacharinis, and then they become congregational members. That's the ideal long-term thing. Of course, clear, because we are preaching movement, there will be always people coming who didn't have that opportunity of being brahmachari or brahmacharini. But just to make that clear, that hopefully in the congregation there is some devotees who've had that experience. And usually we can say, you know, they might be more strong and solid in their ability to give shelter because they've had all that training and experience, you know. But saying this doesn't mean that, you know, a person who has joined as congregational member and who has never had that experience of training cannot be a shelter giver. I'm not saying that. Yeah, yes, but just to make sure everybody understands me properly. But definitely it's a great advantage if a congregational member has had that training, and that's what's Krishna's system, the ashrams. You know, sometimes we tend to think, oh, this brahmacharya life, no use, we can do so much more as, you know, living outside or something. No, my God, you know, it's Krishna's system. How can we think we don't need this anymore or something? No, there's so many good reasons why this is so important, but I don't want to get into that now too much. So, but then when, you know, congregational members haven't had that opportunity, at least they should be well aware of it, that they somehow missed out on this more solid training. And sometimes even as a congregational member, we can still get it, you know, that we are keen in our free time to, yes, when we're Brahmin initiated, get that experience on the altar, do a bit of puja, because doing puja in the temple is a completely different world than doing puja at home. Completely different world. The basic difference is, at home, Krishna has to accept my schedule, what I want to eat at what time of the day, and. But in the temple, you know, we have to accept Krishna's schedule, what he wants to eat at what time of the day, and. So it's a completely different world. I mean, if we think we know about deity worship just from our home puja, oh, we've got no clue, really. It's as soon as you enter the door, it's a different world there, you know? Yeah, you cannot compare to You know, I was lucky I had that training. Even before I married, I had already Brahman initiation. I was trained on worshipping Radha Gokulananda in Sydney, and I was even had Pujari for not very long, but then I got married. So, you know, if one has had that training, oh, that sets a whole different foundation to one's spiritual life, you know. Yeah, so as a congregational member, when we haven't had that training, we should be aware of it, and we should be keen to get it as much as possible. Sometimes young couples, I even suggest to them, why not separate and spend 1 year here in the Brahmachari Ashram, she in the Brahmacharini Ashram, just to get a little bit of training. And then you can get married or something. And I know quite a few people who have done that, you know. So it does the world of good to get that training, just to get that taste for regular sadhana and being fully engaged in service, developing that selfless service mood. Temple life is the best life to get that, you know. Yes. Okay. Yes. Maybe let us move to the next one, which is very tightly connected with the previous one. Should not have the tendency for taking extreme and controversial positions on issues. In brackets, should not be a fundamentalist with Kanishtha mentality, fanaticism. Right? So obviously a person who's got that tendency of taking extreme positions, extreme and controversial, you know, positions, not such a good shelter giver, you know? And ultimately that comes because the person doesn't have a balanced understanding of things. It's imbalanced when we take extreme positions. And often it is also connected with false ego, actually. Then we, you know, this whole fanaticism is a false ego problem, that we somehow, we want to show that we are different, we are special, and oh, look, that's my opinion to this thing. You know, everybody else has the usual opinion, but I'm so different. You know, it's a bit of an ego thing. And there is also a nice definition of fanaticism, which connects with our topic here. If our enthusiasm is not guided by a higher intelligence than our own, we easily become fanatics. Right? So if our enthusiasm is not guided by a higher intelligence than our own intelligence, then we easily become fanatic. It means our enthusiasm, especially in the more neophyte stage, is mixed with a good portion of false ego and mode of passion. Right? Not so pure enthusiasm. So, and that mode of passion and ego affects the intelligence also, and then we can't really discriminate clearly, objectively, you know, if our enthusiasm is actually balanced in all this. And then we become fanatics. Right? So in other words, again, we do need some higher intelligence than our own in order to guide our enthusiasm. What? Yes. And I mean, you can make any good idea, you can take it to an extreme and become fanatic over it. Any good idea. Right? Let's say book distribution. Such a valuable service, of course. But we can just, oh yeah, book distribution, that's the go. And if you're not a book distributor, ach, you're not a devotee. And what? You're not 8 hours a day on the street. What's wrong with you? You know, so, and then, oh, look at me. I'm so enthusiastic about this book distribution and I'm the hero. You know, and then the whole thing becomes poisoned. You know, this ego just poisons everything. Or Harinam, Of course Harinam is great and so important, but Harinam, it is it, the Yuga Dharma, Harinam. You know, and then whoever is not 8 hours on the street on Harinam is in Maya. Yeah? Yes. So any good idea, we can just, the ego takes over and poisons it, and we become fanatics. Right? Yeah, so obviously a person who has those tendencies, not such a good candidate for being a caregiver, a shelter giver, because he will just impart, you know, his you know, ego drives and you know, fanaticism to the others, and you often can see it, that this is really going on, you know, that such people who have that tendency, they really attract people with that same tendency, and the young devotees catch what, you know, they carry in the heart. That's really what's going on when we associate. It's a whole mysterious exchange from heart to heart, actually, that when we associate closely with a person, we catch what they carry in their heart, their desires, their attachments, you know. So that's why we shouldn't associate too closely with a person who has, you know, is full of material desires or is very envious or something, because we catch it, you know, especially if we have a close and affectionate relationship. Bhaktivinoda Thakur also describes that in Bhakti Loka, you know, that those relationships where there is affection, then the heart is open, and then we catch what that person carries in their heart. Whereas if it's just some neutral dealings there at the bank or the post office or something, we are not emotionally involved with that person, then we don't capture so much, you know, contamination there. But when there is some emotional exchange, some emotions are involved, that's when we capture what they carry, you know. Yes, I'm looking at the watch, 9:15 already. Well, let's take the next one, and that's the last one. Should be mature and sober. So, yes, you know, person should be mature, experience, balance, that all falls into being mature, and sober. Sober means, I mean, in English, it's the opposite of intoxicated, you know. It's also used in with alcohol. When you're sober, you're clean, you know. So yes, not all, you know, flying there, pie in the sky, and all, you know, full of not frivolous or, you know, intoxicated by some big plans and this and that, but sober, grave, sober, right? Mature and sober. All right. I mean, already these things we discussed this afternoon, there will be the main heavy ones will be for the afternoon. So you better come back this evening if you can. This is just, you know, it starts with the light and gentle ones, but then the real important ones, they come a little later. So, but already now we can understand properly, probably, that, yeah, not so easy to be qualified to be a caregiver. Already with these few points we discussed, right? So that's why it really puts, you know, a bit of pressure on devotees to actually qualify themselves, to move forward, to, you know, to look at this list. Okay, that's what I should be striving for, to you know, manifest these qualities, so I can actually do something for Prabhupada's mission and reach out to the younger devotees and inspire them and care for them and advise them so they don't fade away again after some time. You know, I mean, really, let's be clear, what's the use of of all our outreach and book distribution and printing the books and translating the books and distributing them, and then off finally there's this special soul taking the book, and then finally there's this special soul coming to the temple and wanting to take up Krishna consciousness. But then there is this lack of care and guidance and shelter, and then very easily we all lose them again. What's the use? I mean, really, I came to this point where I'm not so much interested in this outreach, because I think, well, what's the use? What's the use? Let's establish this whole need for sheltering relationships so we keep all these people who are coming. You know, but we tend to think, oh yeah, we need more devotees, outreach, outreach, outreach. You know, it's like some meat machine there, you know, people in one end, out the other end, you know. What's the use? And of course, outreach, bringing people to Krishna consciousness, is so much easier, actually. You know, this requires some more maturity. We have to come up with some, you know, something deeper to inspire practicing devotees, to uplift them. This is a much greater challenge than just bringing people to Krishna consciousness. So somebody has to take this up seriously, you know, that really people stay and they're ongoingly nourished. That's the whole issue. Bhakti Lata needs ongoing nourishment and care. It's like working in the garden, you know. Planting, growing something is not just a matter of sowing the seeds and throwing a bucket of water on it and then you can forget about it or something. No. It needs ongoing care and cultivation and protection and fencing and this and that and weeds and you know, pulling out the weeds. And so it's an ongoing process. If we want to really harvest this fruit of pure devotional service, it needs ongoing guidance and nourishment and cultivation, and we need help with this ongoingly, even on the level of Baba, Bhavad Maharaj, you know. Yes. Okay, shall we leave it at that? Yes, and to be continued at 7 o'clock, so please be there if you have the chance. Okay, thank you very much. Shila Prabhupada ki.